Hi.
Hi, Alyssa.
Hey, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm good. I am Matthew Iglesias. I'm a fellow and blogger at the Center for American Progress.
And I'm Alyssa Rosenberg. I am a mild-mannered federal management correspondent for Government Executive by day, and by night I am a pop culture blogger at alyssarosenberg.blogspot.com.
Wow. I probably need a more elaborate introduction.
Yeah, well, I write about pop culture. I have to have a secret identity. So.
I see. That makes sense. So how's your morning going?
Good. Gray day here in Washington. You're in Sweden, right?
I am all the way
across the pond.
Where it is, it's sunny and extremely cold. I always forget that it's really cold in some other places.
Well, I have to admit the two things I know about Sweden are that the Soviets got tangled up there and that they have amazing pop songwriters. So
I don't think there were any Soviets in Sweden.
Or Russians. I'm sorry.
Nobody. I don't know. They're free.
Well,
they fought a war with Russia, I think, in the 17th century. I saw in the History Museum. They lost.
That doesn't really surprise me, but the cold should have been an advantage, although I guess it's Russian, so maybe not.
Right, exactly. Yes, pop songs, and well, music in general. They have, I keep being told in my Sweden tourism information that this is the world's third largest exporter of music after the U.S. and the U.K., which are much smaller countries, obviously. There's only 9 million people living here, and lots of bands and things of international renown.
So do they export like actual recordings? Is that what they're measuring? Is that what the measurement is?
I believe so. I mean, I think they're just looking at their, Swedish bands, the Hives and the Sounds. And obviously ABBA back in the day is the titans of Swedish music, and Millencolin, Refused, a seminal hardcore band. I think that's what it is. At any rate, it seems to be something of a government priority. They have a Sweden.se website to, promote Sweden and all things Swedish. And one of the things it has is a, streaming music radio station of just Swedish bands who mostly sing in English to try to promote them around the world.
Oh, that's fascinating. I think I remember telling you to download an album by a Swedish pop star, Robin, a couple of months
Robin,
ago.
Robin, yes.
Did you like it?
Robin is okay. I was, I was talking to a Swedish guy the other day. He was knocking Robin, saying that, in America we have a bad impression of Sweden based on these pop acts, and he was trying to show me some Swedish jazz.
Huh.
Yeah.
What does Swedish jazz sound like? Is there a distinctive Swedish jazz sound?
Swedish jazz sounds, as far as I can tell, exactly like American jazz. One of the strangest things that along these lines I saw was back in the States a couple weeks ago. I went to see what is her name? Ida Maria, who's Norwegian, actually, but she lives in Sweden. She works in Sweden. And she speaks with an extremely thick Norwegian accent, as if she's from a foreign country. But she said at one point, she's going to try a blues song. And then, when she switches into that mode, she's belting it out, doing a dead-on, impression of a sort of Southern African-American woman. For the purposes of the song, but then when she speaks, she knows English, but you would never mistake her for a native.
Well, it's really interesting, I guess, the complaint about sort of Americans having a bad impression of Sweden from the pop acts, if only because American pop music is so thoroughly dominated by Swedish songwriters. I mean, without Max Martin, who is of course sort of the most famous, Swedish songwriter who's taken over the American market, Britney Spears basically doesn't have a career. You Drive Me Crazy,
right.
Oops, I Did It Again, all of this stuff is Max Martin creations. And so what's really fascinating to me about him in particular is the way that he's been able to entirely adapt and roll with the American pop culture market. I mean, he wrote a lot of the Backstreet Boys key songs. I Want It That Way doesn't really exist, again, without Max Martin. But he's gone on to, he's gone from, the boy band and the blondes in the 90s to, he wrote both Since You've Been Gone and My Life Would Suck Without You, both of Kelly Clarkson's huge hits.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, Max Martin is basically like the puppet master behind like American teen pop for the last decade.
Interesting.
You know, and he's not obviously, you know, songs get written by other people, but you know, if there's a big juicy pop top 10 hit, he wrote Katy Perry's Hot and Cold. I mean, he's managed to adapt to all of the changes in the market.
Uh-huh.
You know, despite not being American, and I don't know that you have to be American to write for an American popular songwriter.
Evidently, you don't.
Yeah.
You have to be Swedish.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, you know, there's this duo, Bloodshy and Avant, that's written a bunch of Britney Spears' good songs, too, also Swedish. And then Robin has actually sung backup vocals on, you know, Britney Spears' Piece of Me, Lady Gaga's Poker Face. I mean, the Swedes are all over American pop music, and I can't really figure out why. Particularly not if there are sort of cultural imperative issues that would suggest that that might not be a good idea.
Right. Well, of course, I mean, they would tell you that it's not just an American pop, right? I mean, there's a, you know, a few different sort of, I guess, like linguistically segmented, you know, pop music universes, right?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
There's a Spanish pop music, Chinese, Arabic, and English is the biggest of them all. And, and the Swedes have very successfully, I guess, just, you know, embedded themselves in sort of the international Anglophone pop music universe, so that, you know, they produce, I guess, more English music than Canada does, you know, somewhat less than the U.S. or England does. And I'm not totally sure what accounts for it, other than that there does seem to be a certain amount of just pure path dependency on it, that
right.
people from all over Northern Europe, if they want to get involved in English language, you know, rock music, pop music, whatever, they come to Stockholm. You know, it's the center of an important center of the music industry.
Well, also,
and the Swedish government is, I mean, the Swedish government is very involved in everything over here. It's a taxes account for 50% of total GDP. And they seem to very consciously promote, you know, Swedish music as a sort of an export industry, along with, you know, I don't know what, household appliances and IKEA are the other things they make here.
Well, I also think it's just, I mean, as with all things in pop, success, you know, sort of, it's a rolling stone, right? Like, once Max Martin wrote huge hits in the 90s, people wanted to keep bringing him in because he'd been successful in the past. So, I mean, success really sort of accumulates on itself. I do think Robin's sort of presence as a breakout star in the U.S., even if people in Sweden don't like her that much, mm-hmm. is really fascinating, if only because she's one of few pop stars who both made it sort of on the American teen pop charts in the 90s. I mean, she wasn't like one of the, you know, four big blondes, Pink, uh-huh. Jessica Simpson, Christina Aguilera, and Britney, but she was successful. I mean, you probably remember, you know, Show Me Love or Do You Know What It Takes to Love Me from high school parties back in the day, or from
awesome.
The radio, if, you know, if either one of us actually went
to high
school
parties. If I was invited to any parties.
Exactly.
I'm sure I would have heard that.
Right. But so that, I mean, that she would have been part of the soundtrack of our youth if either of us had something approaching a youth. But, you know, she was pure pop, and Martin actually wrote a bunch of her stuff back then. And then she went back, reinvented herself, sort of as an indie auteur, has her own label now. It's a micro label. I don't even know if she's releasing anyone other than herself, mm-hmm. but reinvented herself as this kind of, you know, weird, kind of slightly scary indie girl who writes really, really pretty pop. And, you know, but once again, she hasn't been marginalized, right, that, like,
right.
by that. You know, she manages to remix Snoop Dogg, and the two of them end up cutting the track together. She, you know, sings backup on all of this stuff. So I think it's fascinating, even in these sort of individual careers, that someone can catch the zeitgeist in America twice. And I mean, that's not a chance that most American artists get to figure
well,
out.
You know, talent counts for something.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, as I was also saying, I mean, the United States is very sort of, you know, present here in a very direct kind of way. I was a little surprised this morning. I turned on the BBC, which of course is not Swedish, although it's available apparently on Swedish cable. You know, and there was sort of live coverage of the guy doing the Chicago Olympic presentation before Barack Obama spoke, just because they were so interested in, you know, I mean, they were saying, obviously, they were waiting for Obama. That was what they were interested in. But, you know, they really wanted to hear him talk about, you know, I don't know what, Chicago and it's, you know, why it's a cool city. And he's incredibly popular in Europe, in a way that, I mean, on the one hand, it's not surprising that, mm-hmm. that Europeans like Obama.
Right.
On the other hand, it sort of is a little surprising to me. I mean, he's a foreign president. And so to some extent, you know, who cares? And yet I saw Dreams from My Father translated into Swedish, you know, on the bookstore in the train station.
So it's something that's still actively selling.
Yeah, I mean, so it seems. And, you know, people, and even, actually, I should say, even stranger than the Swedish translation of Dreams from My Father was that the Obama campaign book, you know, Change for America or whatever, that was on sale in English in, like, some random bookstore on the street.
The gripping narrative of Barack Obama's campaign documents.
Yeah, his now-forgotten campaign proposals. You know, people love him. I spoke to a Danish magazine writer the other day,
mm-hmm.
You know, who wanted to interview someone because, you know, they're covering Obama's four-hour trip to Copenhagen.
I mean, why do you think, is there a clear reason that he's become sort of a pop culture phenomenon? Or, I mean, is it just a sense of relief, or is there something sort of unique and distinct there? I mean, you have the obvious parallels to Kennedy's trips to Europe, but this seems, I mean, that's...
I guess Kennedy's trips, it's, I mean, I don't know. I was in Germany last week during their election campaign,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, people kept saying that, you know, from both parties that, you know, their politicians are incredibly lame and gray, and that they, you know, they wish they had charismatic leaders like Barack Obama. And so I don't know if that's true in Sweden as well. I mean, I guess it is that something about U.S. politics, I guess, puts a premium on, you know, a certain kind of star rising to the top.
Right, but I mean, then, it sounds like what's happening to the Swedes may be not that different than what's happening to a lot of Americans who look at the Obamas and see, you know, they're a very stylish couple, they're young, they, you know, they go to cultural events. He takes her out to dinner. It's, you know, I wonder if it's more that it's just sort of a universally appealing soap opera rather than anything very specific about his campaign proposals. Although I guess if Swedes are, you know, reading his campaign book.
Well, I mean, and I guess in America, because he has to do actual politics.
Right.
As well as being a glamorous figure. You know, he's now, you know, a lot of the sheen has kind of worn off. And
whereas
you know,
in Sweden, he can just sort of show up and he and Michelle can look fabulous and do the, you know, Queen Elizabeth wave from some promenade and yeah.
There's... Yeah. I mean, exactly. And it sort of reminded me, I was looking at the castle here in Stockholm,
mm-hmm.
Where they have a king and, you know, I was asking what does the king do? Like, what does he do all day? You know, because he doesn't actually govern the country. And, you know, I was told he kind of goes around and he like, cuts ribbons, you know, at a lot of ceremonial events and stuff. And it does, I mean, not that I want to say, like, Barack Obama should be reduced to a powerless figurehead.
Right.
But he's very good, it seems to me, at some of that kind of king type functions,
mm-hmm.
you know, like just
the ceremonial stuff where
you
look good and you are the embodiment of the nation's ideal and
and you know you talk about why Chicago should be I guess the other thing I was thinking about was how the king of Spain also went mm-hmm. to went to Copenhagen to talk about why Madrid should get to host the Olympics
mm-hmm.
and you know, there was no political controversy about this in Spain. It was taken for granted. You know, Spain might get this. So, of course, the king is going to go. Whereas in the U.S., because Obama's not the king, you know, anything he does becomes the subject of, like, partisan criticism.
Right. Have you seen the Chicagoans for Rio website? You know, there's that advocacy campaign on.
Oh, yeah. And Drudge had something up, like, highlighting some random Chicago gang murder.
Huh.
To stick it to Obama.
No.
And it was the same when he wanted to, like, talk to school kids, you know,
right.
and tell
mm-hmm.
them, like,
yeah.
oh, you should stay in school. That, again, like, if the King of America had given that speech, you know, nobody would care.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is that America needs a king.
We
you
need
know?
A king.
We need a ceremonial figurehead
yeah.
who can,
yeah, who could be awesome. And, I mean, I think it's probably unconstitutional.
Probably. I mean, I just think people would have trouble adjusting to it. One of the funnier things, when I was growing up, I had a British pen pal, and I couldn't really understand the royalty, and he couldn't really understand the Clinton impeachment.
Okay.
So, but I feel like the state of British, of just European royalty in general is sort of strange. Like, what's the point of being a king if what you get to do is cut supermarket ribbons? Because I feel like
I don't know. Maybe it's great.
But you'd have to have someone with actual power to, like, get the right to talk to school children, right? So I feel like figuring out the balance of power would probably be the difficult thing.
I don't know. Well, I think it's a queen in Belgium, but she, I think, recently had to exercise her very vague and theoretical powers to help resolve some parliamentary crisis. So, you know, every once in a while it comes into being. And the Queen's representative in Canada, her Governor General, it looked a little bit around the end of last year that she was going to have to step in and sort something out. but crisis was averted by Michael Ignatieff.
Fair enough.
I guess because he worked in the United States for a long time and mm-hmm. he felt it would be, you know, inappropriate to have the Queen actually governing a country. Even through intermediaries. I mean, it's a little bit hard to figure out, but I feel like once you start to get used to the idea of a king, you know, of someone who can sort of claim credit for national achievements without it becoming a partisan political issue, makes a lot of sense.
But, like, how would we choose the king? I mean, I feel like we're sort of spiraling off here, but I feel like figuring out who that person would be would inevitably be a partisan process. Like, if we did it as a vote, it might, like, end up being, I mean.
Well, that's tough. Yeah.
yeah.
I mean, Sweden got their king because their army was defeated by Napoleon.
Yeah,
I don't think
we can rely on that to happen.
Right. And the king had no sons, so one of Napoleon's generals married the king's daughter, and he became King Gustav XI or something like that.
I think we should just do it as a popular vote. It would probably end up being Peyton Manning. People recognize him from the commercials, you know? It worked out just fine.
Peyton Manning, King of America. I don't know. Well, okay, so you might be turning me off, the whole king concept.
I mean, yeah, there's not a good mechanism, and any mechanisms we used would produce, you know, unsavory results, I'm afraid.
Well, we could always just take the British king back, queen.
So, well,
they seem like unsavory monarchs, but they do have their famous crown corporation, the BBC.
Mm-hmm. And you were saying that you've been watching a lot of subtitled BBC while on your sort of epic trip across Europe.
Well, no, it was more in my previous leg in Germany.
Oh, okay.
The only English language programming available was all the different British channels. You know, I had my BBC One, my BBC Two, my ITV, my Channel 4, and...
So what did you find yourself watching? Was there anything that, you know... Did you?
Well, you know, I thought... See, because British TV has this great reputation in the United States... Because I guess we only import the shows that are good.
That's true.
But there's a lot of stuff on there that was, like, really uncompelling. Like this thing where people worked in a hotel. But it was, like, all done, like, single camera, like, really hokey music. Like,
did you watch any of the gardening programs? Did you watch any of the gardening programs?
No. I saw a good cooking show.
British gardening programs are fantastic and really should be made over here. My parents really basically don't watch television. And last time we were all in the UK together, just like we're glued to like watching people prune hedgerows and like divot things. It was fantastic. I mean,
how much gardening do Americans really do though?
I mean, not so much, but it's entertaining. I mean, what Americans do is they hire other people to garden for them who they can watch do it. So British gardening shows might be a natural fit.
But don't we really just sort of mow the lawn in America?
I mean, or we hire other people to mow the lawn for us.
Yeah, but there's like a lot of restrictive. I don't know anything about it. I've always lived in cities. I had a garden once. It was pretty nice.
Yeah. So you were saying that you think BBC's reputation is over in 4 years.
Well, I mean, it's not that it's, you know, it's a sort of, it makes sense when you think about it that, like, mm-hmm. the bad shows, you know, just nobody thinks to import. But right. actually, what was striking about them to me was that, you know, not only are they bad, but the production values just seem so, like, cheap and hokey. I mean, in America, even if you see a terrible show like, you know, like The Mentalist.
Right, the camera works pretty good. It's, you know...
Yeah, I mean, it's well shot. You know, it's like you could tell that if the writing and the actors were better, like, it would be a good show.
Yeah.
Whereas some of this stuff on British TV, I mean, it looked kind of like, you know, if you, like, you gave me a camera, you know, I was supposed to put it together.
Right.
It's just, I mean, you know, it's a small country, I guess, so they have little budgets.
But I actually like, well, there's sort of two low-budget aspects of BBC programs that I like. First off, the shows look like they're happening to actual people. Like, not every single person in the frame is wearing Armani. You know, the police stations actually look like police stations. They're not these, like, toothbrush-scrubbed interrogation rooms.
No.
And the people in them look like actual human beings. I don't know if you've watched State of Play, the original BBC miniseries.
Yes, I did. I did.
Well, I love State of Play, and I particularly love State of Play. First off, I mean, the guy who plays the politician, David Morrissey, quite good looking, uh-huh. you know, quite,
yeah.
but, the guy who plays the journalist, John Sim, is attractive, but he's not Brad Pitt. Like, he's uh-huh. normal people attractive. And the guy, Philip Glenister, who plays the police officer who ends up leading the investigation into the murder that the show is based on, I mean, Glenister right. would never make it onto a TV show in the United States. Not going to lie. Like, he has this sort of, he has, you know, you've seen him, sort of pitted skin, a sinister aspect. You know, at best, he'd end up as, like, a heavy on Law and Order. He wouldn't even get to be the main villain. He'd be somebody's henchman. But he's a great actor. Like, he's a legitimately fantastic actor. And so he's not, you know, if he worked in the United States, he'd have no work, but because he works in the UK, he gets to be a major player in State of Play. He gets to be one of the main characters in Life on Mars. Like, he actually gets to have a career. And
right.
I think it's just so much easier to fall into BBC television when the people look like actual human beings. I mean, I'm sure it's partially because I'm not, like, intimately familiar with John Sim's entire body of work that uh-huh. I find him eminently believable as a journalist. But it's also, like, the actors aren't distracting in the same way, you know? Like, when I watch Mark Harmon on NCIS, it's like, well, you're CJ's boyfriend or almost boyfriend from the West Wing. It's like, they're just...
Okay, right. Well, but that's different, just like
sure.
to say, well, you know, you watch these actors bounce around too many times and you get distracted. I mean, like, you know, I was watching yeah. Gossip Girl and, you know, it's Buffy's little sister is on... some other character, and, you know, that's all very confusing.
The chick from Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, yeah.
Right, I mean, and, you know, I mean, really, people should only be allowed to do one iconic role. I'm not that familiar with the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants.
Oh, you should be. My sister and I, you know, go see every episode when they come out, not gonna lie.
Do you? Do you
yeah.
have magic pants that you share?
My sister and I do not have magic pants, and she's, like, 5 inches taller than I am.
Yes.
I guess that would be the point, that if they would have to be magic pants to fit both of us, but no, we've
right.
never been
lucky
enough.
Isn't that
enough.
The point? It's about magic pants that fit everyone.
Yeah, no, not so much. Not so much. I also,
Jeez.
It would be, well, yeah, it would just be inconvenient. My sister and I dress very differently, so I don't really think
Fair enough. but don't we have some ugly people on American TV? Like, who is that guy in NYPD Blue? Who played Detective Sipowicz.
I mean, maybe it's just a trend that's become, like, increasingly pronounced in, you know, in American television. But, like, I can't think of a single person on a major American TV show who just looks ordinary, right? Like,
okay.
It's not so much that it's necessarily ugly people, although there's that true, too. But it's just, like, people who are just kind of plain and average-looking who manage to, you know, be able to inhabit characters fully. Like,
Right. It's an anti-average bias.
Right, like, everyone on American TV looks distinctive, you know, like, Vincent D'Onofrio is probably, like, the closest person I can think to someone who looks kind of average, and even then, like, he falls into the sinister aspect camp, you know? He's, like,
uh-huh.
he stands out because he looks a little bit scary.
Is he the guy on, like, Law & Order 7?
Law & Order Criminal Intent, although he just got fired, which is breaking my heart. They're turning the show over to Jeff Goldblum almost in its entirety, which is one of the stranger moves that I can think of. I really, Jeff Goldblum, The Fly, The Life Aquatic, Law and Order, Criminal Intent, I mean.
Well, that's how he goes.
I guess so.
Yeah, so, okay, right, well, cop shows, which I feel...
You spent all summer watching Dark Blue, right?
Right. Well, I've been watching Dark Blue because... why have I been watching Dark Blue? Well, because I was watching the NBA playoffs back in the spring, and Dark Blue was being promoted so heavily on them that it dove into my brain and essentially forced me to start watching it. And so I set my TiVo to record it. And, you know, every week I would sort of try not to actually ever fire it up and put it on.
But Dylan McDermott's broodiness just got to you?
He has a kind of smoldering quality, yeah. And the show, I have to say, it's really kind of reprehensible. The whole premise of it, I guess, is that it would be really great if there was some kind of rogue unit of undercover cops in the LAPD.
Isn't that the Rampart scandal? Like, didn't we have
that for
real?
Yeah, well, this is what's so weird about it, is that they didn't even, like, pick some other city and be like, you know, what Cleveland really needs is like an off-the-books undercover operation. They put it in L.A.,
right,
where they actually tried doing this in the real world.
I mean,
and it was a disaster.
To be fair, all of American television is set either in New York or Los Angeles, unless it's Glee, and then it's Lima, Ohio, and, you know, who can really explain that? But
I don't know. Is that really true? Well, I guess...
okay.
Weren't there a bunch of shows in Boston at one point?
There were, but it was sort of short-lived. I mean, I guess there was Boston Legal, but...
Boston Legal and Boston Public and Ally McBeal. I mean, that's all one producer.
Yeah, there was a failed show about, like, Irish gangs in Boston, but that aired for, like, 3 episodes. So.
Oh, yeah, my cousin worked on that show. It was really bad.
It looked pretty dreadful. I don't even remember what it was called. The Black Donnellys?
The Black Donnellys.
Gotcha.
Yeah, it was terrible. Yeah, okay, so, right. But, I mean, the point is that, you know, in the real world, when you establish a police unit that's not accountable to anyone or does anything, you know, it becomes, like a cesspool of corruption and abuses. And they even, to some extent, illustrate that on Dark Blue. Like, they're always doing crazy things and running all kinds of risks and endangering the lives of who knows how many people, and all, like, for the most pointless stuff. It's like, they never even purport to make it be like, well, now that we arrested this one drug dealer, like, the whole narcotics problem in America is solved.
Right.
But it's like I remember when I was a philosophy major in college, there was this question about, you know, in a fictional story, you know, you can make it so that things that are false in the real world are true in the story. And could you make, like, ethical claims that are false be true in the story? And I feel like Dark Blue, it's in some ways an exploration of that theme. You know, can you make it somehow make sense that this is what we need? Like, cops who can barge in without warrants and, you know, just shoot people for no reason, all in some, you know, crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, who even knows why? It's like they cut deals with some crooks to get other crooks, but it's not. And I have to be clear about this. It's not like a deep show,
right? It's
dedicated to exploring the moral gray areas or something. It's just unrestrained celebration of basically out of control rogue cops.
Well, the thing that I find, I mean, I haven't watched Dark Blue. I managed to resist Dylan McDermott's piercing stare. But I think American cop shows have this really interesting relationship with brutality, right? I mean, I don't know if you've ever watched Law & Order Special Victims Unit, but
yes,
Elliot Stabler, male half of one of the teams of detectives, basically beats up suspects a lot. And it's not like, there's a lot of, like, slapping people in the face or, like, you know, the classic move is, you know, the two fistfuls of somebody's shirt and the person jammed up against the wall. But the show, you know, has made it so he beats a suspect unconscious, and then they decide it's a problem. Like, there's a line, but it's pretty far out there. You know, Bones which I love, you know, really funny, great depiction of, like, nerds on television, you know, repeatedly the main characters, like, slap people around or, like, shoot people, admittedly people who are, like, trying to kill their partners, and there are never any consequences. I mean, and just no discussion of it whatsoever. It's like, there's no, geez, maybe you shouldn't have shot that person, huh, maybe we're making up, like, too many resisting arrests, or, like, he assaulted me and got in the way. It's like, it's become comic at this point. Like, there was an episode towards the end of, I guess it was the third season, where one of the characters is being stalked. She shows up to try and kill David Boreanaz's partner, Emily Deschanel, and Emily Deschanel shoots her in the throat. Like, she dies on screen. It's, like, it's kind of astonishingly brutal, and there's absolutely no discussion of it in any subsequent episode or the subsequent season whatsoever. Like, she kills someone. And
right.
It's almost entirely casual. Like, it's background noise. And I think most of us, like, find that totally appalling in the real world. And it's very, I mean, I don't even think, like, Dark Blue has to do a thought experiment to get there. I think American cop shows are kind of there already.
Yeah. Right, well, and, you know, I always do think it's a little strange. You always hear a lot of discussion of 24 in mm-hmm. the context of sort of torture and national security debates.
Right.
But, you know, 24 is just building on this very long legacy of sort of small-time torture, but with much lower stakes. I mean,
right.
The thing you can always say on behalf of Kiefer Sutherland is that, well, a nuclear weapon is going to blow up a whole American city.
Right. I mean, it's not like, where are the diamonds? Tell me where the diamonds are.
Right. I mean, whereas on sort of standard network cop shows, I mean, it's regularly seen that threatening or, you know, that actually beating or threatening suspects
and the stakes
is sort of a routine investigative method in what are often, you know, pretty low stakes kind of things, like, well, someone was murdered, and, you know, I mean, obviously it would be better to solve the murder, but it's not like anyone is saying
well, the stakes are often, I mean, you know, I think it's very precisely correlated, right? Like, if a child is about to be molested or murdered, like, you're allowed to go further than you are if, like, there's been, you know, if there's a robbery, for example, that goes wrong.
Sure.
It's like, it's not okay, really, to beat up a robbery suspect, but, like, child molester is totally fair game. And I think it's, like, I think those are smart, you know, smart decisions on behalf of the producers, right? Like, people
No, I mean, of course, right. But, I mean, what's still, but, I mean, they're not, they're never, you know, they're not the sort of dramatic cases that we talk about in these political controversies.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, they're crimes. They're violent crimes being investigated. And, I mean, it's an interesting counterpart to the sort of narrative of, like, liberal Hollywood, that you have what's probably the primary genre of network television in the United States.
That medicine, yeah.
Right. I mean, and it's always putting forward, you know, what I guess you would say is, I mean, not just in terms of the brutality, right, but on these cop shows, particularly the Law and Order series, really promotes the view that, like, securing criminal convictions, you know, post-arrest is really, really difficult, that, you know, accused suspects have all these, like, really clever lawyers, and judges are really, really solicitous of their rights, and, you know, and it's never... It's never that, like, some guy gets railroaded because, like, he's poor and has an inept public defender, right? I mean, it's always the reverse. It's always that the legal system is this, like, minefield that law enforcement has to navigate. And
well,
that stuff just bears no resemblance to reality.
At the same time, I mean, the Law and Order DAs have an extremely high conviction rate. Like, Casey Novak, one of the, you know, Special Victims Unit, ADAs, was supposed to have, like, a 70.4 conviction rate, which is absurdly high. Like, absurdly high. But, yeah, I mean, it's not that every superstar lawyer in New York just ends up working for, you know, working under Arthur Branch in the district attorney's office. But, no, you're right. I mean, and I think, you know, the crimes on the Law and Order series are almost always very personal. You know, they're like, and it's kind of fascinating to me that people still like watching this stuff and like watching this sort of reaffirming vision of the criminal justice system, even at a time when crime has totally vanished as a national political issue. Like, It's unthinkable right. to think of there being a major Obama administration crime bill, or, you know, even the administration taking on gun control in any, like, major substantive way.
Right.
But, you know, we're still, and, you know, there's been a lot of writing about the fact that it's, like, what American viewers like to watch on TV is crime and medicine. And, right. you know, right now we're in a period where we're back in the middle of the healthcare debate. You know, this season of House has actually been advertised as, like, they've been doing a lot of, like, he's what the system needs. Like, this, you know, sort of renegade, rule-breaking doctor who will, like, go above and beyond for his patients. Insurance never shows up as a subject on House. But, like, right. there's been a lot of riffing on the healthcare debate. There are, you know, there are a couple of new medical dramas up this season. Mercy, which has Michelle Trachtenberg, also of Gossip Girl and Buffy. But it's fascinating to me that crime shows persist, you know, even as crime's just dropped off the national scene. And I'm not really sure why it has. I mean, you know.
Well, crime, I mean, is seems to me like a classic, you know, dramatic premise.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, completely apart from its real kind of social impact. You know, particularly because you can get these things, you know, it lends itself to the kind of, like, episodic coverage of
yeah.
television, too, you know, which is part of what makes it great.
Right. The procedural is a perfect form. Anything that you can sort of get down to, you know, an hour-long story and then have a larger arc, you know, it makes a lot of sense. But,
it still is noteworthy how sort of fictional America on television is.
Right.
Is this incredibly, I mean, the real world United States is very violent compared
mm-hmm.
to other developed countries, but
right.
it's nothing compared to, like, Law and Order America.
Yeah. I mean,
in which New York City is, I mean, if you extrapolate and figure that there are other detectives.
Yes.
Other than, like, the eight guys who are shown on the different series. Right.
right.
I mean, New York is just, like, awash in blood constantly.
Well,
and nobody ever comments on it, you know? Like, nobody at the station is ever like, man, you know,
crime
really
is
good
hot,
at
yeah.
solving these crimes, and yet there's, like, such a plague of violence everywhere. Like, what's the
yeah.
problem?
What's
wrong with
them? There's no societal context for any of the crime on Law and Order. It's interesting. I think it was Michael Kinsley did a big piece in Slate in the, like, 2002, maybe,
uh-huh.
about why sort of successful professional women watch Law and Order. Which I thought was really fascinating, because I only started watching Law & Order. I really only started watching TV, period, when I moved down to D.C., was living entirely by myself for the first time
uh-huh.
in my life, and started watching Law & Order because it was comforting, right? It's like, if you don't leave the window on your fire escape open, nobody will come in and rape you. It's like, it was essentially life lessons. And I think, like, Law & Order in particular is appealing, because it's like, it offers, you know, very simple lessons that you can do to ensure your own safety. Not that they're, like, realistic, but it's like, perhaps you should not get involved with the charismatic diamond thief. Like, that might be a poor
right.
decision for your future survival.
Well, that makes sense.
And it's reassuring, right? Like, you know, America is, like, a violent, scary place, but as long as, like, some serial killer isn't going to emerge from prison after 15 years and, like, announce that he's your father, like, things look comparatively okay.
I guess, but I mean, still, at some level, too, it also, I mean, like, not that I follow, you know, say, NCIS all that closely, but the way that, like, television is able to gin up this, like, completely obscure criminal agency, and
yep.
then, like, they have tons and tons of crimes they need to deal with,
oh,
it seems
yeah.
to me to actually paint, like, a far more threatening portrait of society than exists. And then at the same time, if you look at all the, what's it called? The CSI shows,
mm-hmm.
right? Which there's, like, three of now. the cops on the one hand are portrayed as, like, having way more capabilities
yes.
than real police officers.
They can do magic, basically.
But much less actual efficacy.
Yes.
Than real police. And to be, I mean, I guess overly serious about it, it's just when you talk about how police departments get effective at reducing the amount of crime in their city, if you read books on this subject, like I know Mark Kleiman, who has a great new book out, did a Blogging Heads I think a week ago. You know, it never has anything to do with, like, well, what detectives need is, like, a more magic fingerprint detector.
Right. Right.
And, you know, I mean, I guess it would be boring to have a show that was all about, like, well, where are we going to concentrate resources and, you know, doing with this. But even not getting into, like, incredibly squishy liberal soft-on-crime stuff.
Right.
Just about, like, you know, what is it about the police that, like, helps reduce the level of crime? And, mm-hmm. and it's just so different from this kind of, like, sleuthing that dominates the TV portrayals. And, you know, I think it's too bad because it's obviously, like, it's really bad that people get murdered in America at such high levels. And it would be, I think, you know, helpful if people had some kind of understanding of these issues.
Well, that's what
or at least knew they had no understanding rather than constantly having like thrown at them this crazy version of it.
Well, that's what The Wire is for. I mean, come on. I want to go back. I want to go back to your mention of NCIS, which has a new spinoff this fall. So, which I find yes, NCIS Los Angeles, starring I think Chris O'Donnell and LL Cool J of all people, and also Linda Hunt.
Navy related crimes.
But what's really strange to me about NCIS, and it's one of the few shows that's about like an existing government agency that isn't just like the FBI. And my readers at Government Executive love it because it's one of the few shows that's, you know, about federal employees. But what's really strange about it is, like, I mean, the show implies, sort of like what you were saying earlier, that the Navy is either a bastion of people, of huge numbers of people who commit horrible murders, or of people who are just disproportionately victimized by absolutely insane crimes. It's very odd. But it's also...
Yeah,
like,
I mean, in the real newspaper, you're just like, there's never, like, an NCIS story.
Right. But, I mean, the, you know, the Naval Criminal Investigative Service does exist.
No, I mean, of course. Yeah. But, I mean, it's just not... it's just not, you know, the Navy is not such a hotbed of crime.
No, I mean, at least we would hope not. At least, certainly, at least not that we know. But I think it's really fascinating to me that, you know, the only way people like to look at government agencies on television is if they're solving crimes. You know, there's actually, I think it's a Ron Howard, Brian Grazer pilot about the IRS under development. And I have no idea what the show is going to be about. Like, I sort of assume it's going to be like The Office, except the IRS will be the setting, and therefore there will be, like, more customers who complain about things. But, you know, both NCIS and Bones and, you know, Bones is interesting, but it's, you know, a partnership between the FBI and the Jeffersonian Institution, which basically implies that there's, like, a huge crime lab somewhere in the Smithsonian, which I have to say would be pretty awesome. But, you know, it's like we're comfortable with bureaucrats when they're solving crimes, or there's this whole, like, strange narrative about the federal government having, like, a lot of secretive things hidden, like the whole Night at the Museum narrative and, you know, the National Treasure movies. Like, the way Americans see their government through television is very, very strange and very skewed.
Sure, I mean, I want to see, like, the Bureau of Labor Statistics show where people, I don't know what, they're just, like, they're compiling all this data and putting it out in text files.
You know, if you can find the network that will develop that, I would buy you a beer just to see that happen.
It could be great. But I mean, well, so I joke, of course, but I mean, this is, I mean, of course, there's very few shows about any kind of private sector activity other than being a doctor. Right. And it seems to me that in shows where people's work is like, isn't integral to what the show is about, you know, but it's just incidental that like people are constantly being architects.
Because
like that sounds interesting. But you never see a show like about I don't know what, you know, like whatever it is people do.
Yeah, I mean,
in America. Well, you know, like middle management at Walmart.
But that's why NBC's,
you know, it's not dramatic.
But that's why NBC's Thursday night lineup is so interesting, because you've got The Office, which is about, like, totally random mid-level, you know,
yes.
white-collar
work. The Office definitely is.
I mean, 30 Rock is about people who's, and, you know, 30 Rock is about the elite spectrum of people's work lives, but it is almost entirely about people's work lives, you know, whether it's Jack Donaghy buying a German television station, or, like, Liz Lemon not being able to balance, like, you know, dealing with a bunch of crazy stars and, like, having dinner. You know, I don't know if you've seen this new show NBC's got going, Community, which is about a lawyer who's found to have faked his bachelor's degree and so has to go back to community college to get, you know, a legitimate college degree. And it's fascinating.
Would that happen?
What? Does that happen? I mean, I...
Yeah, what kind of rule is that?
I don't really understand it. Like, there's not a lot of...
He retroactively unpassed the bar somehow?
Basically. They're like, if you want to keep your bar certification, you have to get an actual college degree. But there's not a lot of detailed setup here, you know? I mean,
yeah.
It's...
No, I understand. But, wacky premise.
Right, but what's interesting about the show is that it is about, like, ordinary Americans, right? I mean, you have,
right.
like... a guy who was a football star in high school and like lost his scholarship and is so trying to get a degree somewhere. You've got Chevy Chase playing like a small time entrepreneur who's, you know, kind of a jerk, but like you feel for him a little bit.
Yeah, but see, like this show doesn't sound very interesting.
It's hilarious.
Like if some of these guys solved crimes,
but
that would be better.
But it's hilarious. I mean, it's, you know, it's sort of a fish out of water comedy, and Joel McHale from The Suit plays the lawyer, and he's like tall and sort of manic and very, very, very funny. But it's also like, the people are real people and still manage to be interesting. I don't think that, like, the ratings on the show are apparently tanking. I have no idea if it will last.
Because none of them are cops.
It's true. If one of them was a cop going back to school, then it might be interesting. If it was about crimes on a community college campus.
That could be good. Or, I mean, obviously the ultimate show would just be, like, doctors who treat injured cops.
Yes. Well, isn't that sort of what trauma is? It's new,
new,
you know, about a trauma unit working with the police department somewhere. It's, you know.
Of course, Scully on the X-Files was both a doctor and an FBI agent.
Yes. So the ultimate
television character.
Yes, it is the ultimate television show.
Right.
So
should we do an awkward transition to Long Book?
Sure, absolutely. I know you spent the summer reading Infinite Jest and decided that it had been sort of unrewarding, right?
Well, I mean, just that...
Not
what was I saying? You know, it's like it's really long, which obviously I knew when I picked it up. But having... You know, there's so much entertainment in the modern world. What with all these cop shows, the internet, fucking, you know, Swedish bands and things you could be listening to. There's so much more happening than there was in the classic era of the giant novel.
Okay.
Right? That it seems so anomalous to read. So like, and this is, I do think, part of like the point of this particular work is to be, you know, deliberately kind of anachronistic and out of keeping with the spirit of our times. But still, it's really out of keeping with the spirit of our times. And I sort of wish I'd read, you know, like two or three good shorter books, because it's not like I've read every worthwhile book in human history or something like that. So, you know, I should probably like get a list of like the top 100 books I haven't read and then sort them according to which are shortest and, you know, just start at that end or something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the thing about... Oh, go ahead.
No.
I mean, I think the thing about like big long books, and I totally take your point about prioritization. I mean, you're talking to someone who basically grew up without television and is desperately trying to catch up on everything at once. And like, I'm like, you know, I'm like a puppy with a ball. It's like I chase after something really fast and then chase after something else. But I mean,
just wait till my Bureau of Labor Statistics show gets.
I know. I'm going to be hopeless.
I'll have to be glued. Yeah.
I'll be totally entranced. But we also have a lot more time than people did in the days when, like, the big, great books were getting written, right? Like, it's not like you have to, like, plow the fields and, like, milk the cow and then, like, maybe you get 10 minutes before bed to read. Like, we have a huge amount more just free time and leisure time than we did before. So, I mean, yes, there are more options, but there's also just more time in which to explore everything.
I don't know. Like, I still have to work. I mean, it's my work is
so
not
impressive.
Like, it's not, you know, physically demanding the way plowing the fields would be, but it still takes all this time.
It's true. I mean, it's not like you have, you know, but you have a point. Like, obviously, we do spend sort of a societally mandated eight hours a day working. People like us also do freelancing, etc. But like,
And like weird like internet video recordings.
I know. I mean,
and we expect people to watch this, right? So, like, who's gonna read, you know, War and Peace with this kind of compelling digital alternative available?
though, is like at a time when everything is super disposable, when there's so many options, I tend to find reading something really long and exhausting really, really rewarding. And that may also just be because I read ludicrously quickly. Like, I did my annual reading of Possession this year. It took me 4 days. You know, I realize that's sort of insane. But, you know,
so
you
might just be smarter than the rest of us.
I don't think I'm smarter.
That's your argument.
I'm just fast. But I spent, like, last year I spent a month reading Underworld. I mean, it took me absolutely forever. I'm not going to lie. And I loved it. I mean, it was something, it was continuity. You know, it was something that I had in common over that whole month, that, like, I was going to dive into this thing that was really, really difficult for me. I mean, it's, you know, it's all of these interlocking narratives that drop off and start, you know, start up again that don't even necessarily connect to each other. You know, it's this, but it's just this very vivid imagery. I mean, the book starts with this, you know, amazing description of a baseball game that's being attended by a whole bunch of people, some of whom are famous, some of whom are not. But there's this.
Yeah, I definitely read like the first 50 pages of that book.
Right, but there's this, like, there's this amazing image when J. Edgar Hoover is sitting at the baseball game, someone's torn off the Life magazine with a reprint of, you know, Bosch's famous painting of hell. And so he gets this image of hell drifting down to him. Then you get these apocalyptic images later in the novel of, you know, this nun who basically seems to be going crazy. And, like, just being able to fall into prose that rich and with that kind of continuity was just sort of an escape for a month. You know, it was a way I could just sort of get away and let myself be overwhelmed by something instead of trying to manage my time and making sure that I saw everything. It was just like, it was nice to have a project. And maybe that's, you know, maybe that's not the way people want to spend their leisure time. But, I mean, I do think that, like, in a world where we're constantly distracted, and it's like, there are, like, 12 TV shows I'm trying to follow right now. It's nuts, right? Just having something where...
Yeah, that is nuts.
You know, having something where I just turn off everything else I'm doing. Like, walking away from my computer, which I'm not particularly good at. I think it's a relief.
But see, maybe what we need is, like, a service, like an RSS you could subscribe to, that'll, like, send out 1,000 to 3,000 word chunks of, like, long books at, you know, random intervals.
That would be great. If Amazon wants to do that through my Kindle, I will be very, very happy to subscribe.
My Kindle, I just, here, let me hold up to the camera, my broken Kindle, because I thought, when I, before I left on this 3 week trip, I thought, you know what would be great to bring on this is a Kindle, because I could have all these books, right, but all in this one slim kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it turns out that this Kindle screen is, like, highly vulnerable to damage if you do things like put it in your bag while you're on a plane.
Did you have it in a case?
No, I did not have it in a case.
Well, that seems
had it as it came.
Yours didn't come with a case? Mine came with a case.
I don't know.
I have an old school Kindle, though, so maybe they came
with a case. Well, if it needs a case, either way, I mean, if the thing is not robust enough to be put in my bag along with my computer and the rest of my gadgets and brought over to Germany, then I don't really, I mean, you know, what good is it? And then so they very kindly, you know, are sending me a replacement one, which is nice. But, of course, it doesn't help me with the fact that I had meant to carry all these different books electronically. Fortunately, in Sweden, they sell English language books at all kinds of stores. But, you know, Amazon, I think, has to work on this concept a little. Broken Kindle screen looks kind of cool, like a sort of an Etch-a-Sketch gone mad.
You just need a case for your Kindle. I think you should get a case. You're getting a free new Kindle, so get a case, and then you won't break the second one. Not to, like, be your mom. But
I guess. So, but it should be designed. The screen should be designed so that it doesn't just, like, break instantaneously.
And I'm kind of a big believer in taking care. I'm kind of a big believer in taking care of your toys.
I'm a big believer that things should be not so fragile.
What were you going to read on your Kindle?
What was I going to read on my Kindle? I don't know. Good stuff, probably.
You can't even tell anymore?
Really, really intelligent, edifying material. No, I can't tell. I have no access to it. I think I had a history of Germany, some kind of, I don't know.
Sounds very virtuous of you.
There must have been good things.
The thing that I was going to say about long books, though, is, like, I totally believe in short stuff. Like, I spend, you know, I spend a disproportionate amount of my reading money on graphic novels, because that's something that I can whip through in, like, an hour, 2 hours. You know, yeah. I believe in, like, I mean, I don't think that, like, one should only sit here and read the great books. I did enough of that in college. It was a lot of fun. It was very sure. edifying. But, like,
you but know. But I really just meant, like, some of the great yeah. books are short.
Oh, absolutely. But I think, you know. Like, you know, I just don't think, I don't think length needs to be a deterrent is really all
right.
I'm saying.
Well, okay. At any rate, I think the length of this chat may be starting to become a deterrent. so we should close it up as we approach the hour mark.
Yes, we can bow to the, you know, the modern viewer or reader's attention span and sign off. So.
Exactly. All right. Well, good talking to you.
Thanks a lot, Matt. Bye.
All right.